Here we go again. Question time. What do we have here? First question coming off here. Ajahn, letting go can be a problem for some of us, especially if we've had unreliable caregivers in our early lives. It can lead to problems with self-trust. What is the Buddha's teaching on the idea of inner friend, Kalyana Mitta, have to offer in aiding our ability to let go? Okay, one of the best Kalyana Mittas of all, that's like a noble friend, is the Buddha. And so if you have like trust in the Buddha, like your good friend, in other words, that the teaching of the Buddha was all about letting go, giving up, not doing anything, going against craving, going against ill will. So that is like a nice caregiver. After a while, like, you can trust in that Dhamma, because whatever you do in life, as long as you trust in that Dhamma, it always tends to work out. So sometimes, you know, you take a bit of a few risks. You know, you're very, very generous even though you can't afford it. You're kind when you really haven't got the time to do so. And you meditate even though sometimes you think, you know, it's a waste of time. You just do it out of... you do it out of, like, sometimes faith. I must admit there's been some times that, you know, because, you know, like most of us, and I hope most of you as well, got a rebellious nature. And sometimes you rebel, you know, I'm not supposed to be able to meditate now, I'm tired, or I'm sick, or, you know, it's too late, or whatever. There have been times when I've just been so tired, maybe been into town for, you know, the weekend, and lots of things have happened. You get back to your monastery, and there's more things in the monastery you've got to fix up. But by the time you get to your room, you're just, you know, really tired, and you should really just go to sleep, and it's late at night. But a few times I said, what the heck, I'm going to just try and meditate, see what happens. And you get some marvellous meditations when you just, you know, you go against the stream. You know, you do things in a weird way. You rebel. Just see what happens. Sometimes you're sick. You're not supposed to be able to meditate. You try. Just see what happens. And a lot of times, that when you least expect it, that's when you get the best meditation. And this is what the Buddha was saying. So, like, the what you're really trusting, you start to trust in the Dhamma. You go for refuge in that Dhamma. You know that if you really let go, that nothing can go wrong. That peace must be good, and that the happiness which comes from letting go, the Buddha said many times, you don't have to be afraid of that happiness, indulge in it, go for it. And sometimes, you know, people get a little bit of happiness and they get afraid, they think they might get attached to it, and then you've got your paycheck, you know, someone's giving you all this gold and you say, no, not today, thank you. So when these things happen, just please accept the happiness and actually trust the Buddha said this is worthwhile doing. And so your inner friend, your real inner friend, becomes like the Dhamma, the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. You know, you understand, you know, what really Dhamma is, you know, the source of things. It's freeing, it's calm, it's peaceful, it feels good. One of the great teachings which the Buddha gave, he gave it to Mahaprajapati, the first nun, he gave it to Upali, one of the great Vinaya scholars, all became arahats, who said that whatever teachings, whatever practice, you know, leads to things like peace, leads to calm, leads to, you know, things fading away, disappearing, emptiness, freedom, all those sorts of things, you know that must be the teaching of the Buddha. And that's how you recognize those things. You know, if they lead to peacefulness and calmness and tranquility and a sense of ease. It's good actually to have some idea of, you know, like the goal of nirvana, you know, the ultimate happiness. Many times you have all sorts of ideas of what nirvana is, but that's one of the best definitions of enlightenment, like ultimate happiness, ultimate peace, the ending of all desires, the wanting for nothing. Imagine that you have everything you ever want in the world. You want for nothing, and that's nirvana. Wanting for nothing. Now the thing is, in the world, how can you want for nothing? People want to accumulate things and think, once I've got enough, then I want for nothing. But you find it's never enough. The other way is just to be content with how much you've got now. And then you want for nothing. This is enough. Good enough. Contentment. Freedom. Have you felt free during this retreat? That you're sitting here, there's nothing you want. You don't need jhanas, you don't need enlightenment, you don't need the next moment. You're completely full. You want for nothing. This is just absolutely perfect. You get some taste of what enlightenment's all about. Perfectly happy. No matter what's happening. Completely content. Full. Don't want anything. Isn't that nice? Freedom. First time in your life, you want for nothing. And that's the sort of like the Dhamma of the Buddha. And that's the best friend. And if you have that, then that will give you a lot of care. That will really protect you. You want for nothing, then no one can take that away from you. So, if you had unreliable caregivers in your early life, all caregivers are unreliable. My goodness. You know, wives, husbands, you all know how unreliable they can be. And parents, you know, they try their very best, but you know, parents, you know, they're all unenlightened beings. So when you get reborn, you don't know where you get reborn into. And so sometimes they try their very best, but sometimes, you know, it's not always do the right things because they're human beings. So you know, whatever we have, all external caregivers are unreliable. But the inner caregiver, the Dhamma, that will look after you. So that's one thing which I'll go for. Have the Kalyanamitta, the Dhamma inside of you. Even like monks or nuns, they're unreliable too. You know, sometimes I'm not here, I go to Singapore, and if you want to blame anybody, you know who to blame now. And sometimes in Singapore, sort of, you know, I say I'm not in Singapore enough because I have to be here. So everyone is unreliable. In the end, we all have to leave each other. Say, oh, why are you leaving me now? I haven't got jhana yet. You can't go yet. But these things are unreliable. So the only thing you can rely upon is that emptiness. That's the only place you can sit on. Okay, anyone want to say anything about that?
Just want to ask you, because yes. You said that emptiness, that if you move towards the place of emptiness, where you're not planning and doing all that sort of stuff that you've been talking about, does one's life start to actually be led by intuition? You start to get flashes of things that, like the way you go from out of nowhere?
That's right, yeah. Because a lot of times you're very, very sensitive. You know the right way to go. You know that story of Cat in our monastery? Kit Kat, you know, we took him to this because he was always eating birds. He had a little cat who was born in our monastery, so we looked after it. But then started eating all the birds. It's the wrong place to have a cat in the bush, in the Australian bush, because there's too many birds there, and this is what cats do. So, quite reluctantly, even though I really liked that cat, we had to take it into Perth. Found a nice home. Someone would give it a home in Watermans. Now, you're in Perth now, those of you who don't know Perth, our monastery is about 60 kilometres south of here, in the forest. Watermans is maybe about, what does it say, 10 kilometres northwest of here, by the ocean. Okay, and we've also got our city centre, it's about 5 kilometres due north of here. So, we took that cat, we put it in a bag, so it couldn't see where it was going. We put it down where your feet go, in the back of a car. So it couldn't see out the window. And it was taken along the freeway, all the way to this house, in the bag, taken inside the house, and then let go inside the house with the doors locked so it wouldn't run away. For 3 or 4 days, she kept it in that house to make sure it got accustomed to its new home. She was a very, very kind lady. And the first time she let that cat out of the door, that cat just ran for the gate. And she couldn't chase it. She couldn't keep up with it. And the cat went down the street. She got in her car and tried looking for it. She couldn't find it. It was a Saturday during the summertime. And I happened to be on duty in our city centre in Noramara, 5 kilometres north of here. And so she gave me a call. I'm terribly sorry. Your cat's run away. I've been looking all over. I can't find it. I said, oh, never mind. Maybe you'll sort of turn up. Because, you know, sometimes that's what happens. The cats actually find their way back to their home, the monastery, down a certain time. But no, that's not what this cat did. 2 hours almost to the dot, it turned up at our city centre in Noramara. out the door there, meowing away. And I couldn't believe it. Because that cat had never been in the city of Perth, the metropolitan area, in its life. That was a fact, I know that. And it found its way from one of the suburbs of Perth to the only place where there's someone who knew it, in the whole city of Perth. Crossing freeways, crossing roads, not being able to call up the REC or ask a priest in the way. Now that's actually like the intuition. Some people say it's a smell, but I do wash my robes. And you can't smell a monk sort of, you know, 5 or 6 kilometres away. And not in the city. And that cat found me. And that's actually what happens with the intuition. When you're very silent and still, you know which way to go. You know which way to walk. You'll always find your way. But if you start thinking, you'll always make mistakes. So it's great when you sort of get quiet and silent, and then you just know what to do. And it's always right. The next question. If you want to try that, turn out all the lights tonight and find your way back to your room. No, I can't do that. You might get find someone else's room. Sorry.
Happened to story to keep that in.
Oh, we took it back to our monastery because it deserved to go in the end. The birds had to just take their chances.
I've heard stories of dumpsters on people across the Atlantic Ocean, they came back.
That's right, yeah. I don't know how they managed that. There was one case during the First World War where a man in Yorkshire, that's the north of England, got drafted into the army, sent over to France, and that was a terrible war. There was bombs going off everywhere, and people dying, and goodness knows what else. And his dog followed him. You know, his relations, the first letter they managed to send, they got to him after a couple of months of writing it, to the front in Belgium somewhere, and said, "I'm very sorry, your dog's run away. He ran away a couple of days after you left." And he wrote back saying, "Don't worry, it's found me already." That dog, you know, from Yorkshire, had managed actually to cross the English Channel. How he'd managed to do that, get in some sort of boat and sort of stow away and actually cross the Channel. And then once got into Europe, managed to find its owner amongst all that noise and the millions of people there, millions of soldiers. Could actually find the one person who was its owner, its friend, the one it loved. In the middle of all that, it's amazing. Now you can only do that if you've got very peaceful and you just follow that intuition.
And just the theory of more peace and the more thick connection people and things, animals and people.
Yeah, it's called global positioning, mind, sensitivity. You've got a GPS inside of you. Dear Ajahn, after many years of Vipassana, a friend of mine continuously got into states where he could hear other people's minds. It got so bad he ended up committing suicide. Well, that's really sad, isn't it? He went to many teachers, but none helped him relieve his pain. I have another friend now who also gets into these states. He tells me he not only hears people's thoughts, but also feels the emotions that something them that worry them, I suppose. Yeah. Do you have any suggestions to help him go through this in a healthy way? I must admit, I never like to put down some traditions, but sometimes Vipassana is so hard and people get so tense. And sometimes, because there's no softness and not much joy there, sometimes because they get their mind so tense that we get a bit out of control. And I can actually almost guarantee that they're not hearing other people's thoughts, but they're hearing their own thoughts and their own imaginations there. If it's really listening to other people's thoughts, you can turn it on and off as you will. It's because it's coming from a quiet mind, a powerful, a joyful mind. That's where the energy comes from. And hopefully many of you will see that during this retreat. At least you'll have glimpses. It feels so wonderful, so beautiful. You feel energy in the mind. And what you look at, what you see at, you can see deeper into it. In the same way that you can actually see deeper into another person's mind if you want to look in that direction. When you get that power, you can look in a leaf and you can see it, just so much detail, so green, so much richness there. You get the idea of what the power of the mind can do. Of course, that's only like a low power. It has to be much higher power than that to read another person's mind, but it can be done. But it doesn't sort of create sort of problems like that if it's real reading other people's mind. Because it's power, energy coming from you, can actually soften it, you can raise it up again, you can soften it, you can raise it up again. But no, it's easy to do. Just letting go, you focus or you don't focus. So if it's somebody who's actually thinks they're reading people's mind again and again and again, it could be, you know, a bit of schizophrenia coming there, I think, more likely. They're hearing voices, and they're thinking it's somebody else. But most of the time it's not. And especially if they can't turn it off, that's what it seems to be. And if they're sort of feeling emotions as well, then that's probably a classic case of... Now, I'm not an expert in those areas, but it seems to be that's what it's pointing to. So if someone's actually done that, they've just gone too hard into the meditation. Forcing. When you force too much, then things break. That's why, you know, it's not good actually to force. The Buddha tried that, was Bodhisattva, 6 years trying to force his mind, go through pain. Okay, this is it, I'm going to really sort of get to my meditation now. You know, enlightenment or bust, let's give it everything we've got. And that's just too harsh and too hard. You never get into bliss with that sort of hardness there. And that's why, you know, the first time I went over to, I think, Malaysia, people started complaining about samadhi headache. And I thought, that was really crazy, because I never had a samadhi headache as a monk meditating, because that's samadhi bliss, that's all. I couldn't find out what people were doing, and it was just far too hard. Too much ego, willpower, I want to do this, I've heard other people do it, I'm going to get it as well. I can do it. And they get this macho sort of state of mind where they force everything. And if you get that macho state of mind, too much force, it can be very dangerous. This is what happens. But the type of meditation which you've done here is very soft, very calming. You're actually letting go of yourself. Which is what Buddhism is supposed to be. Letting go of ego, letting go of self, of me and mine, my meditation, I'm doing it, I'm in control of all of this, this is mine. And you see the way I've been teaching here, it all fits together about when is not a self and not a me, no spiritual materialism, no trying to, you know, keep up with the Joneses and sit along with the person sitting next to you. If you all come, let's say, you know, come together from Singapore, you're not going to go back on the plane and say, well, how did you do? Oh, that's no good, that'd be much better than that. If you start, you know, talking like that, you're missing the point. There's no spiritual one-upmanship here. When there's no spiritual one-upmanship, there's no sense of ego, there's no sense of self, there's no, like, drive. That's craving. That's second noble truth meditation. I want. And that's what creates that stress, that suffering, and, you know, that's can create that sort of suffering. If you really consider doing another person's mind, you get so much bliss anyway. There's no way you'll want to commit suicide. You'll just be blissing and just be walking on air. So you can't commit suicide from that sort of place. So it's more than likely it's done it too hard and had a bit of schizophrenia there. So if you've got someone like that, go and tell them to go and see sort of a psychologist.
Some of the
Israel,
because he has an appreciation in the
Buddhist. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Anyone sort of who's, especially a Buddhist, has got some idea what's going on and see what the person's been doing before they commit suicide as well. Yeah, you have a question?
When you've done
Long
Pho Phut, say that if you have sin as a foundation, and then beneath you protected you from the all the five hindrances. And then later on you won't go into the long path in terms of like for example reading somebody of mine or something like that, which is actually create delay. But so that is not the same as that one. There's a difference between mental illness and the like ability that you obtain during the meditation, but you can also take the wrong turn. It is not the right part of the
Buddhist tradition. It is, yeah. What he's saying is, it's very one of those funny things in language, that sin, you know, like we have sin in Christianity, that's actually the Thai word for sila, which is morality. So,
that's confusing for the Thai Catholics.
Yeah, so Thais really like sin. So very, very simple nature. And the more sin they have, the better. Which means the more precepts they have. And what I actually say that this monk said, if you keep your precepts, then of course that protects you. And it's actually it's almost like a self-protecting mechanism, because you do need a basis of morality, of ethics, of goodness, to actually begin into deep meditation. You need that deep meditation to get powers. And what happens sometimes is that you've got the precepts and you're a very good person, you get some nice meditation going, you get some powers, but it's like the sense of ego and self, pride, conceit, and that sort of comes up. And you know, that's one of the big problems at that time, because that's not really covered by your precepts or even by your meditation. You get some nice experience, and say, oh, this is really good, now I'm enlightened, look at me. I can read minds, I can do things. And what happens is, because of that conceit, you know, if you think, you know, that's you, that's yours, then eventually you start misusing those powers. And as soon as you start misusing the powers and you break your precepts, then your meditation fails, the precepts fail, and the whole thing disappears. And it's interesting, you see, you know, quite a few people, even in our modern age, who seem to have started off with being really good people, keeping precepts, doing really good meditation, even getting powers, but they've misused them, and then they lose their powers, and then a lot of the time they end up faking their powers afterwards, and out of pride, because you know, they used to have the ability, they haven't got it now, and because of pride, because they've got a reputation, they're famous gurus or something, then actually they start faking it, just out of pride. But they've lost it now, because they've lost their basic precepts. It was pride which killed it. And that spiritual pride is an important thing to look out for. And so, the way I've been teaching here, you're not doing it, it's nature. So if you're getting good meditation, there's nothing to feel proud about, there's no one in there. It's nature, that's all. If you get terrible meditation, you don't need to feel bad about yourself, there's no one in there. There's three conceits, I am better, I am worse, I am the same. You're just completely pushed aside. No more than you can judge children in the school. They may be in their first year in school or their last year before they go to university, and you look, those kids in year 12, you know, before university, they seem so much smarter. They are so much cleverer than those idiots in the first grade. But of course, you know, you can't talk like that. You can't compare children in the first grade will eventually get to grade 12. Just the people in grade 12 have been there longer, that's all. So if you've got really good meditation, you can't compare yourself to the person sitting next to you who hasn't got good meditation, just you've been there longer, that's all. And they'll eventually get to that stage, you can't compare anymore. And so that pride disappears. When is pride? When is a sense of self? It'll always be grasping. And when is grasping? It's tension, tightness. When is tightness? You get those psychological problems. And that's where you get those people going a bit crazy or wanting to commit suicide. They're just too tight, tense. You can't stand that too long. Eventually something breaks. So in this meditation, it's letting go, being peace. And you can feel the freedom, the ease. And you should know that's healthy. It feels so healthy. It feels so good. You go back from here and you're just a much nicer, kinder, more caring, more peaceful person. You even feel more healthy. So if that didn't work, if you went back from here sort of really more miserable than when you came, more uptight, more angry, more selfish, my goodness, but you know, what's the point of coming? And that's how you can actually find out if it's a good meditation retreat. So, it's a very nice question, but be careful. Sometimes, even in this type of retreats, people really try hard. I'm going to really try hard to let go tonight. This is it. I'm going to go. Come on, let go. I'm going to really let go. And of course, that's doing the letting go. That's trying. Rather than just allowing it to happen. Just be controlled. I was saying today during one of the interviews that they have this character in Buddhism called Mara. M-A-R-A. And that's, you know, the person who always tends to get in people's way and stop them becoming enlightened. That's like the enemy to wisdom. And Mara lives in the realm of those who wield power over others. he is the one with the biggest control freak. The control freak. Want to wield power over others, to control others. That is enemy number one in Buddhism, Mara, the controller. And when beings become enlightened, they're out of his control anymore. And he gets really worried. I can't control you anymore. Now do you get the point? That Mara is right inside of you, the controller, the tyrant. And as soon as you let go, then you're out of Mara's control. He's trying to say, come on, do some meditation. Come on, get up, don't go to sleep. Come on, do this, come on, do that, come on, do that. That's Mara speaking, shut up. Let go. And then Mara is no longer there anymore for you. Mara is defeated, according to the text, by saying, I know you, Mara, by recognizing that control inside. That thing which wants to achieve, which wants to change, which wants to get happiness, which wants to get rid of pain. Whatever it is, that control inside, that is enemy number one. And it is overcome just by recognizing, there's a control again. Once you see who that is, then you can just let go. Then you're at peace. That's the problem. So, Dear Ajahn, can you please explain what is Ashwara? Ashrawa? Is it merit or karma? What does that mean? Ashrawa. I don't know what it means. I can't explain it. You know what that means? Ash?
Asawa.
Asawa. Okay. Sounds good. Okay. Asawa. Is it merit or is it karma? Asawa is the outflowings of the mind. That's when you can sit here and you can see there's nothing to do. And it goes flowing out to that beautiful mattress and pillow. It's already there. It goes, flows out to that breakfast tomorrow morning. I wonder what we're having for breakfast tomorrow morning. You always have something special. Maybe croissants tomorrow. Oh, wouldn't it be nice? It's already flowing out to breakfast. It could flow back. And that's the afterwards. You know, what takes you out from your nice, content, calm place and takes you out into the world. It's amazing just how much we go out when we don't really need to go out. We've got a nice comfy place in here and we blow it all by thinking about something else. Whatever takes you out from inside your heart, inside your mind, out there into the world, or into your body. You've got the other sounds outside, nothing to do with you. You can think about the sound of the traffic or the sound of the birds or the sound of others. Does that really help? Does that shut it up? But why do we always send our mind out to the sounds? A lot of times it's because, you know, the sounds or other ears, it's like a protective. We feel unsafe if we're not listening, because that might be a murderer out there, or might be sort of some danger out there coming in our direction. And so that's why even a cat will always be listening even though it's sleeping, because of trying to, out of fear, trying to protect ourselves. And so eventually when we're in a nice protective place, a place where everyone feels safe, then we can actually let go of thinking about sounds. We can't hear them anymore. But when we're really unsure of ourselves, then we'll always be listening to those sounds. That's why when you first go to a new place, it's very hard to sleep at night, because the sounds, you're always listening to sounds, just in case. That may not be the sound of water coming into the wash tub. That might be the sound of a chainsaw massacre of the redemptive monsters coming for you. Whatever it is, whatever it is, because of fear we can't let go of sound, we're always listening. So it takes a bit of confidence to let go of sound. And let's just say, afterwards, for whatever reason, it takes you outside into the world of sound. And actually, especially when you go inside in the deep meditation, you're right inside, you wonder, why do you ever want to come out again? It's so flowing out into the world. You can actually see that happening. That's what the arsenals are. The mind flowing out into the world, out into the past, out into speech, out into doing things, out into messing around with the world. That's what arsenals are. Any questions about that?
Can you just explain what the four arsenals are, please?
Okay, sometimes it's called three, sometimes four. The three one is Kamasawa, which is about sensuality, around the five senses. Like you flow out towards sight, sound, smells, tastes, touches. Well, that feels interesting. What's that? and there's the asava of just being, just want to exist, you want to do something.
Is that the same as being, is the same as doing, or are they
yeah.
two different ones?
No, to be is to do.
Okay.
You know, you've heard me say that one before. That was it Descartes said to be is to do? And Jean-Paul Sartre turned it around and said, no, it's not to be is to do is to be. And that was all summed up by the great American philosopher who said, dooby dooby doo. And that was Frank Sinatra. And that actually was, I saw that on the wall of, they had this really nice graffiti at Cambridge University. That was on the wall of the philosophy department. when I was at university, someone had scored it on there. No, to do is to be, sort of René Descartes. To be is to do, Jean-Paul Sartre, and dooby dooby doo, thanks a lot. But actually, yeah, it's karma, the bhavasava is a being. And they got like, I think avijasava is like ignorance, delusion. Because of delusion, we want to go out there, we think there's going to be happiness out there. For those seeking the happiness somewhere else.
Building advanced
insights here. That's right, yeah. Because we think, you know, because we think happiness is out there in the future, that when you find your soulmates, you know, just waiting out there for you, you'll be happy ever after. And when you sort of win the lottery, oh, then you'll be happy ever after. Now, when I get jhanas, then I'll be happy ever after. And you see, you're sending your mind out there to get jhanas, and you never get it that way because you're looking in the wrong place. Or when I become enlightened, then I'll be happy. So this asava is going out there into the world. Spiritual materialism, physical materialism. That's the asava that's going out. Yeah?
Sankaras, how does it relate to
that? Sankaras is what we manufacture, like the buildings, fabrications. So see, we go out there and we actually make a world for ourselves. We make a family, we make all these problems. A lot of this is fabricated stuff. And so then you wonder, why do we keep making problems for ourselves? A lot of times because, you know, we want something to do. Basically. Because when we do things, then we think we are somebody. We make problems, and we like making problems, because then we're important. And that's why, you know, go and talk to each other. Oh, you wouldn't believe all the problems I've been going through. Because you feel important that way. You know. And that's why, you know, people like these tough jobs. Sort of, you know, in the government or whatever, because they've got so many problems to do, they feel really important, they ask somebody. If you didn't have any problems to solve, you know, you sort of don't do very much, you feel that you're not worth very much, you know, you're not being.
So it's all aspects of mental formations?
That's mental formations, yeah. Your fabrication. I like the word fabrications, because fabrications, you know, what you make, and then like fabrications almost got a sense of like, deceit with it. So I like that word fabrications. It's all false. You're just making something out of nothing. You don't need to. Like, you know, we have like grief when somebody dies. How much of that is fabricated? How much is real? Even like sex. How much is that fabricated? How much is real? 100% fabricated. We're taught to believe it's pleasurable, but not really. It's burning, but because of our conditioning, we really think, yeah, it is. We buy into it. We never challenge it. We never question it. We never know anything other. Therefore, it's just a sort of fabrication. The great deceit.
Disaster was always leading to fabrication.
Last was usually they go out there and they do something. They build up something.
Natural tendency to go out, and we start making,
running with the ball, and then we make a really big house, and then we make a really big mortgage, and then we have to work even harder, and then it just keeps on fabricating, going on and on and on. And once you start that, it's very hard to defabricate. What kind of rebirth and merits can one expect for our 1 week of practice? We're leaving already. How much have I got? Now I said about no expectations. About what kind of rebirth and merits can one expect for 1 week of practice here, even if we do not get enlightened, or for that matter, for the rest of this life, if one continues to practice and still does not get enlightened? Now that's called a fabrication. So, no, you won't can expect. You know that right now, how do you feel? Whoever wrote that question, how do you feel? And that's the merit you've already got. You feel so peaceful, so nice, so at ease. You're already getting merits. If you die with that state of mind, you're so peaceful, so calm, so at ease, then you get reborn in the peaceful, the calm, the easeful realms. If you're not fabricating, you get reborn in the realms which don't fabricate. You don't have to work so hard. If you've got not letting go, you get reborn in the realms of letting go, so you don't need anything, you don't do anything. It's peace, the peaceful realms. So as your mind is, that's where you go. But if it's wanting, 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 how much they get out of this, then you get reborn in the wanting realms, called the realm of the hungry ghosts, who's got small mouths, big tummies, so no matter how much you put in, you can never get enough in there to satisfy your stomach. The realm of the hungry ghosts. So that's where you want a lot. So how many want to be a hungry ghost? Very good. I don't want very much. Hello, hello. I know there are many religious schools that teach various subjects as well as world religion, but are there any Buddhist schools that teach meditation, integrity and wisdom to children? If not, why not? Okay. I must admit, because I was a school teacher before, I thought that maybe Buddhist schools are not such a good idea. Although there's a couple of Buddhist schools in Singapore, the reason why I thought is because just like children not really old enough to get married and choose a partner or have sex because they're not mature enough. Now, aren't really children mature enough to choose wisely a religion? And too often, because you know, you're brought up in a Christian school or a Muslim school or a Buddhist school, children almost get indoctrinated. And they're forced to be Buddhist or they're forced to be Catholic or they're forced to be Muslim. And by that time, just their minds can get very easily be closed. So I know that there are sort of Christian schools and Muslim schools, and because there are those schools, then perhaps there should be Buddhist schools. But the idea would be to have no religious schools, no schools which prefer one religion against another, because I think it's unfair on the children to expect them to choose. Now at that age, when they're just too young, of course, you know, most people here would say, well, you know, as long as they choose the right religion, Buddhism would be okay. Buddhist schools would be okay, but not those other schools. But you've got to be fair, everyone thinks theirs is the right religion. And you get some of these fundamentalist schools, these madrasas apparently, which create terrible problems in the world. They completely indoctrinate children. I think even in Christianity, I think they said that. I think one of the founding fathers said, give me a child and Jesuits, yeah, we'll make you a Catholic for the rest of your life. Isn't that a rotten thing to say? So, you know, like, it'd be much preferable, I think, to teach children the different religions of the world as part of human culture, human knowledge, just our heritage. Let them understand each particular religion, what it stands for, what it teaches, but not promote one against the other. And let them in an age of maturity, whether it's 16 or 18 or whatever, when they're old enough to choose their partner in life, let them be old enough then and only then to choose their religion in life. And let every religion stand on its own merits, not one nor another preferred because of some government or because of some other incentives. Let there be what you call a level playing field, and let some market forces, the right religion, if it's a good religion, you don't need preferential treatment. And then children can choose for themselves. Let's teach them goodness. And goodness doesn't have to be associated with any religion. Kindness, generosity, tolerance. Those things can be taught to children, but without giving it the name, this is Buddhism, this is Catholicism, this is Islam, or whatever. So I must admit I'm idealistic there, but having been a teacher before and having seen like Christian schools, and if you go to a Christian school, you've always got that incentive there, that impetus. And whatever you teach, it's always taught, you know, and biased towards Christianity. And I thought if I had a Buddhist school, you know, that it would have to be, you'd be biased towards Buddhism, and I think that's a bit hypocritical. So that's what I think anyway for schools. I mean, because children aren't, if they're not old enough to choose, you know, who they're going to live with, they're not mature enough, you know, to be able to have, you know, sexual relationships with another person, well, why should they be considered mature enough to have a religion?
about in Thailand? Aren't school all Buddhist?
No, mostly secular. It used to be part of Buddhist monasteries. It used to be the monks would be the ones teaching, just in the same way that most universities were actually Christian monasteries. Cambridge was just a group of monasteries, that's all. Mostly by the Dominicans, friars. But things change, religion's got secularised now, I think it's continued to be more secularised as people see the problems with like religion, brainwashing children at a very young age, and see some of the problems in that. Of course, most schools are very, very good. There'll always be, if you have one religious school, you have other religious schools, and some of those will be used for, you know, the purposes of just maintaining our religion and our particular doctrine in that religion. And I don't think that's very healthy. And I think in Thai schools, I think religion is taught, but I think not very much. It's mostly secular. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. We went to the school in the temple, but we only learned Buddhism maybe once in our 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
Not all the time.
Not all the time. But I imagine that even though you may have only been taught of Buddhism once a week, many of the attitudes of the teachers would be Buddhist attitudes.
Yeah.
And so it would be taught, you know, almost subconsciously. As Christianity can sometimes be taught subconsciously in Christian schools. Just the attitudes of the teachers, the way they explain history, the way they explain maths even. So anyway, that's, yeah, go on.
What about meditation?
Oh, that's great for teaching that in schools. Because meditation, you can't really call it sort of, you know, religious as such, it's just calming down, making the mind peaceful. But unfortunately, that many people have actually taught meditation in like schools in Perth and have great results. But then as soon as some parents have found out meditation equals Buddhism, isn't a religion, they take their kids out of the class. You know, because of, you know, like being dogmatic and saying, oh, if it's Buddhist, it can't be good. It's some sort of evil. But the results speak for themselves. There's one lady who's been teaching, used to teach meditation in her year sixes, year after year after year. The headmaster of the primary school was a Christian, because I went to see him a couple of times, and he told me, like, I'm a Christian, and she's a Buddhist, she teaches meditation, I don't care that it's Buddhist, because it works. He said, the kids in that class do so well. And both in behavioural problems, they really go down. Everyone is very, very kind. Whenever there is a problem in the class, someone puts their hands up, Miss, can we have quiet time now? And they just have quiet time, they all sit down and do a little meditation, and then the problem's solved afterwards. And sometimes if there's any kid having a problem in the classroom, it actually increases their loving kindness. Just by quiet time, they become more sensitive to one another. And year six kids, they're great, and they are actually very caring. And you know, the boys, the girls, they feel that someone's having trouble, they go around and look after them. And become like a care in class. And not only that, just their learning ability really improved by just having quiet time. So the ability to concentrate, to care, and have very few discipline problems was so remarkable that this Christian headmaster was just so convinced. So she can do that as long as she likes, and I'll support her. And he was actually standing up and arguing with the very strong Christians. You know, he said, oh, you shouldn't allow her to do this. He said, he should. And he was actually sticking up for her. So it does work, and there have been many other studies of that being done. But because it's associated with Buddhism, some people think, oh, you can't do this. It's just promoting a religion in the school. But, you know, it's not really religious, it's just quiet time. Okay, the next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I was trying to do the body awareness meditation when the breath became so loud I had to watch the breath. Could the breath become like a demanding child always wanting your attention? Is it possible to love the breath too much? So, and sometimes what happens, one of the reasons why the breath is so loud is because the mind gets peaceful and calm. Then the mindfulness becomes strong, and when the mindfulness becomes strong, everything gets amplified. It's not just the food tastes more delicious. It's not just your pillow feels much softer. It's also, you know, the breath, if you pay a little bit of attention, it's much more pronounced, it's more loud, it's more rich. I think that's one of the probably what's happening there. But it could be also because you're paying no attention to it. And because before you've asked to pay attention to it, and then when you let go, then you can see it clearly. If that happens next time, if the breath really wants your attention, okay, just stay with the breath. So be kind to the body. Let the mind choose what it wants to really see. And don't really worry too much about what object you're watching. It's how you're watching it is the most important point. You're watching it with kindness, with softness, not trying to control things, then you go in the right direction. So it can be the breath or the body. So if the breath really comes up, we're doing body meditation, just, okay, breath, I'll watch you for a while. No problem. Okay. It wasn't really loud because no one heard you. Otherwise I'd have a note in here. The only other problem, this afternoon I came across boredom and restlessness. Yes, even after your varieties of spice of life talk. I tend to be satisfied with my state, and although this was much better than fighting it, I still found it difficult to be truly at peace and content with it. Afterthought, I think I just figured out I expect to feel peaceful and content for most of this retreat. Obviously, this is not necessarily so. Expectations are a killer, that's for sure. Do you have any comments or suggestions regarding boredom and restlessness in this retreat and in life in general? Yeah. Boredom. Now, really, you should make an investigation of boredom. Because boredom is the most fascinating subject. Now, what does it feel like when you're bored? Where in your body do you feel boredom? What does it actually feel like? Is it in the left side of the body or the right side of the body, or is it all over the body? And actually, does boredom change? Does it get really bored and then not so bored and then go really bored again? How does it change in its amplitude? And actually, what does it do to your thinking pattern? And if you do an investigation into boredom, actually boredom becomes an incredibly interesting subject in boredom. And of course, as soon as it becomes interesting, the boredom's gone. This is the thing, actually, to investigate, get interested in it, and then boredom's actually has to be gone anymore. So what boredom is, I don't want to even investigate this, I don't want to do anything. Because it's not actually watching the present moment, it's not really investigating. So you can make fun of it. The same like tell people if you're afraid of ghosts. And if a ghost comes to your room, this is a magic opportunity to make a lot of money. Get out a pad and a pen and interview that ghost. It's so rare to get an interview of a real ghost. And there's so many questions people like to know about ghosts. Like, do ghosts get married? And if they do, they have a little kid, there's a baby ghost. And what the heck do they do during the day? Because they only come out at night. Do they sleep during the day? And if so, where? And so you have an interview with a ghost, like an in-depth. What does it really feel like, you know, not to be wanted? And, you know, you can sort of get psychotic ghosts. Do you ghosts actually, you know, go and have parties together when other people aren't around and just hang out with each other? Well, what do you do? You're loners. So imagine asking all those questions, and they can actually get an interview with the ghost. They can go in New Yorker, they can go in sort of, you know, the Sunday supplements. My goodness, that you syndicate that all over the world, you make a fortune. So the next time a ghost comes, don't get afraid, say, come over here, come over here. So what are you doing then? When it's fun, you can't get scared anymore. No, fear is completely ghost. So it's like boredom. The reason why it's boredom is because no one investigated. So you investigate it and boredom is undermined. So about restlessness. You be at peace with restlessness. Stop trying to get rid of restlessness. Stop running away from it, because that's more restlessness. Rest with your restlessness. So I'm restless, that's fine with me. It's just cause and effect. Maybe because I had too much tea, or because, you know, too many funny jokes, whatever it is, you know. So I'm restless. So be restless. Say, restless, the door of my heart's open to you. We can't stand that. Restlessness, you know, just gets completely undermined. You're taking off the power source, the fuel source of restlessness, and restlessness just goes. So just make peace with restlessness. allow restlessness to be. Rest with the restlessness. And then there's no restlessness anymore. That's how you get rid of that thing. But if you rest with it, expecting it to go, that's not resting with it. That's doing the old business deal. I'll let you go as long as you disappear. That's not really letting go. Letting go has to be 100%. Restlessness you can be as long as you like. Then it goes. If you expect it to go, it'll never go. Okay. Next question here. Dear Ajahn, could you please speak on a compassionate heart and how it would work in today's world? I noticed a one-legged magpie in the garden. I really wanted to help, but I couldn't help with that, nor it seems within the world. A one-legged magpie. Perhaps it likes to be one-legged. And I say that because sometimes we help people thinking that we're doing the kind thing, and yet they're already happy, they're at peace with themselves. It's not a magpie being one-legged which is a problem, it's actually its relationship to its one-leggedness, how it regards it. Maybe it's at peace with its one-leggedness, it's no problem anymore. Because this magpie has probably been living here for many years, it's probably heard many of these talks already. That might be an enlightened magpie. And you're sort of putting all your chips on it. So that sometimes we think we're being kind. One of the stories which really moved me many years ago, there's a story of a boy who was born deaf, couldn't hear, when he was about 7 or 8 years of age. At the regular checkup with the doctor, who just checked him up, the doctor managed to talk with the parents who were with the boy and told the parents they just read in the medical journal a new procedure which works in 10% of cases of boys born deaf, they get their hearing back. If you want to give it a go, it's only 1 in 10 chance. They say, why not? I mean, to give someone their hearing back, it's worth it. So they put their child under this operation. After the operation was completed, that child was one of the 10%, got his hearing back. And that child was so angry and upset at his parents and doctors. Why didn't you ask me first? I couldn't hear what you were discussing. You could have actually told me in sign language or written it down. I don't want to hear. He said, now I've got this terrible noise I've got to deal with. Before I had that problem, I had such a happy life, I could actually feel the world. I knew the world much better through touch, through sight. And now you give me this other sense which I never really wanted. At least you should have asked me first. When I heard that, I thought, my goodness, I assumed also that everybody wanted to hear. And this is our problem. The Western world assumes that everybody wants to have a video and wants to live as crazy lives as we live. But do they really want that? They have all these aid projects, and what are they really there for? Sometimes it's imposing what we think other people need. We never really ask them, what do you really need? What do you want? We assume too much. We should have asked that boy, what do you really want? Do you want to hear? We assume that everyone wants to, but he would have said, no thank you. Leave me alone. So that's the trouble with compassion sometimes. You should ask that magpie, do you really want another lesson? maybe it doesn't want it. Usually actually it's got the other one tucked underneath somewhere. It really has got two legs most of the time, but it's just got one underneath. So that's why compassion should always go with wisdom. If we've got compassion but no wisdom, then we make so many problems in the world. Just like the Boy Scout who took the old lady across the road out of compassion when she did not want to go. That happens too often in life. To have wisdom with compassion. Now when you have both, wisdom and compassion, then you know you are really compassionate in this world. Then you can really help. So have both. Ajahn Brahm, I lost my partner about 10 years ago. I still continue to give merit after doing a good deed. Can he benefit by it? If he is born in this world and if he's about 8-10 years old, how can that child know that the person that previous birth people are giving merit? Is it also correct that after 10 years that person cannot gain merit? Just depends where the person's been reborn in reborn as or to. And usually it says it's only the realm when people haven't get reborn yet can receive merits, but I think that's not exactly true. Anybody who is a close friend or close relation to you, if they are hurting, you will know it. Someone told me a story when I was in Melbourne last time of this vet who was finished work on a Friday afternoon and was going off to a party in the countryside in Victoria. Really looking forward to a weekend with his friends. Finished work, a nice weekend, feeling on top of the world. In the middle of the journey, just outside of Melbourne, he was just overcome with this really, really strong emotion. He didn't know why, there was no cause for it at all, but it was so strong he had to pull off to the side of the road and just wept uncontrollably for about 10 or 15 minutes. He didn't know why, an emotion just flooded over him. And he got back in his car and went to his friend's house, where the party was over the weekend. It was only when he got to his friend's house he realized he was told it was a call from home. His dog had been run over by a car and died. He never knew that. But the moment that dog was killed, just afterwards, that's when he got flooded with this emotion and just had to cry. There's another friend who's a Buddhist in Sydney. He literally did run away with one of the circuses as a kid. And he got in with the elephant trainer. And the head elephant trainer, they were moving in their caravans from one place to another. He was looking after the elephant. Halfway on the journey, the elephant just started going crazy, banging in the trailer. And they had to stop to try and calm the poor elephant down. It was trumpeting and banging around. They found out the elephant trainer ahead had had a fatal accident in the car. The elephant knew. And that was going crazy for this time. Just like the man knew his dog had died, but not sort of wasn't told, he just knew. It's the same way that if anyone close to you gets hurt, some of you feel that something's wrong. Maybe something's wrong with Diane or with Joseph or whatever. You feel that. Now when you're close, you do have those connections. And that's actually well documented. You may have had experiences like that before. If it's someone close to you like that, those connections will still be there, mind to mind. And if you dedicate merits to somebody, you really wish them well, they will feel that, even if they've been reborn in this life, whatever realm they've been reborn into. Obviously, the longer distance there is between the time we were together and the time now, the weaker that link will be. But it also depends on how close you were together beforehand. And if you're very, very close and really in tune with one another, and even after many years, if you spread merit, goodwill, happiness to that person, they'll probably feel it. So there's no time limit of 10 years. Obviously, the longer it is, the longer space, the more we change, the less we become in tune with each other, and therefore we can't pick up each other's wishes or feelings. But certainly in the first few years we can. Closer you work to that person, then obviously the more sensitive they'll be for the longer period of time. Does that make sense? Okay, next question. So carry on making merit, even if it doesn't get to them. There's other people who can share that merit. You speak of jhana and of reaching jhana along with the now experience and different perspective of looking, seeing things which defies conventional wisdom. Is it possible that if one lacks depth, maturity or understanding of practicing Dharma in our daily lives, we may not have that wisdom to handle such a powerful experience? Instead, such a gift may be used by the less scrupulous to promote mumbo-jumbo. Can such an experience distress a person if he or she cannot handle it? Would it then become very important for a teacher to guide you through it? I know you asked for one question per person. My apology is giving you a three-in-one. They are all related. Here they are. Again, tomorrow morning's talk will be on jhana, because lots of people ask those questions, so do the jhana talk tomorrow. But usually you can't really get jhana unless you've got some wisdom. You have to have an amount of wisdom to get jhana. That's why it's actually said by the Buddha. One of my favourite quotes from the Buddha, Dharmapada verse 372. It's Nati Jhana Gopanyasa. There's no jhana for one without wisdom. no jhana, there's no wisdom. But he also says there's no wisdom without jhana. The two go together. But in the one who has jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. That's a powerful saying. If you've got jhana and wisdom, you're that close to nibbana, to enlightenment. But here, you need some wisdom to get jhana. From jhana you get wisdom. The two go together. So little by little we understand what letting go is. We understand that we're not in control anyway. We understand enough of non-self to be able to let go. Enough to enter jhana. We don't control, we're not afraid, we're not afraid of losing anything. We just allow everything to become peaceful. And we're not afraid of the joy and the happiness as well. So usually, a person who gets jhana, they usually have enough wisdom to understand what's going on. However, there are rare cases where people fluke a jhana. They manage to press the letting go button when they don't really deserve to. But it happens. It happens sometimes. And then, of course, it really blows their mind. What the heck's going on? I've had some amazing experience, which completely doesn't make any sense with everything else I've experienced in their life. And that's what it's very helpful to have a teacher. Someone who knows what they're talking about, who knows those states, to be able to explain at length what they are, exactly what happened, why it happened, what to do about it next. And that becomes very useful to have a teacher at that time. So, nice question. Does that answer it all? Yeah. Oh, one, two. Yeah, you first.
Translate that into like day-to-day language or day-to-day speech. Is reasonable to assume that your one's lifestyle needs to be not such a jump between there and the state of jhana, as opposed to like have a very different lifestyle and then a big jump?
Yeah, if you have a certain lifestyle and then sort of you just manage to fluke a jhana, the whole thing becomes just so challenging. Because, you know, there you've got the best blissful experience in your life and you haven't done anything for it. You know, better than sex, so, you know, your sexual drive will just diminish quite a lot because you've got better happiness over there. And you see many, many things about the mind, and, you know, things like rebirth, the nature of the mind, the nature of the body, death and all that sort of stuff. It really challenges you. It would be like an epiphany experience, which, you know, changes your whole personality and your whole way of looking at life a lot of the time. So, the more of a change you have, I mean, if you're living a really sort of indulgent life and you get one of those, and that's really going to challenge your lifestyle. So it's obviously it's much more smooth if you just move up to that sort of slowly by getting a more peaceful, kind, gentle lifestyle, not craving and wanting so much. Then when the jhanas happen, it's not too much of a contrast. Is that something you're saying?
Yeah, I just wondered whether, in fact, I'm really alluding to the idea of approximation to jhanas. I know that there's a difference between nimitta and jhana, but in terms of your take-off point, your background level, how you're vibing in your life, you know, which things...
The less you control...
The question of peace is increasing.
The more you're a loving person, which means you're not controlling, a peaceful person, you're not wanting so much. So those are really big control freaks, have a very hard time getting things like jhana. Yeah.
So, wisdom and jhana, then they're permanent, isn't that?
They're what?
Permanent, like...
In a sense, no, not really permanent, but the wisdom is like permanent. Once you see things, then sort of you tend to see things always in that way. Not the wisdom of facts, but like the ways of seeing things. That's why once you're enlightened, you're always enlightened. Once you have wisdom, then that wisdom, the underlying wisdom, will always be there. Yeah.
Can you actually not want to have jhanas due to ignorance?
Oh, it's great if you don't want jhanas. That's the best way of getting jhanas. It's not wanting. Just freeing. Because again, these dharmas are stages of letting go. They're the results of not wanting things. So when you give up all wanting, then you become still. Because there's nothing to force your mind to move anymore. And the more still it becomes, the closer it gets to dharma. And it gets so still, then the dharma happens. But any wanting disturbs it and you go in the opposite direction. So those who want jhanas will never get it. Those who don't want it they've got more of a chance. If you know what I mean. Okay, next question. We are the owners and heirs of our karma. How does karma apply to a country such as USA for its actions in Iraq? I would expect a similar answer regarding the other coalition partners, like Australia. Okay. It is, like, individuals are the owners of their karma, so karma is an individual thing, but we tend to do things together. People go to war together, they fight in battalions, they fight in sort of groups of soldiers, whole armies to fight each other. And so when you make karma together, sometimes we receive the results together. So sometimes we do things in groups, we receive the fruit of those actions in groups. And sometimes, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, why so many people died on the same day, or, you know, the 11th of September. 11th of September? Yeah, that's right, yeah.
October.
12th of October, yeah. Sometimes you can understand if people went into battle together, or like gang, like some of these gangs which were in the streets of rough parts of cities, they sort of beat up people together, then they get some of those results together as well. So sometimes that happens. So that's actually how karma applies. But it's not the whole country didn't go to war with Iraq. You know, certain people made those decisions. And so those certain people have to carry the karma of those decisions. Certain people went to war, and those people have to carry the karma of going to war. So like, karma is individual, but because individuals do things together, there is a way of looking at group karma. Next question. Yeah, Jan, in the Metta Sutta. Please elaborate. Do not hold to fixed views. Thanks with Metta. With Metta from the Metta Sutta. It's not actually to hold to wrong views, is actually the real translation, because it's this word ditti. You can say it's fixed views, because a lot of fixed views are wrong views. And what it really means is actually to let go of those old views which have been fixed in you by conditioning. Because so much of the way we look at life is our cultural conditioning, our social conditioning. What we want to see, what we want to believe, that's why it's called fabrication, sankharas. We made up this way of looking at the world. And now in meditation, you're going to be challenging that to the root. How you look at your world and how you look at yourself. I mentioned the other day about how perception can change. So what was once a white towel now looks black. That's really weird. How can you do that? Well, like some people, they look at a person and the person turns into a skeleton. You know, looking at you and now you're a skeleton. What the heck is going on? Am I going crazy? No, it's just perception. It's just changing. The skeleton was always there. It's a different way of looking at things. When we've grown up, we've been taught how to look at things, how to listen to things. We've been given names, and names have their meanings, and we've been taught how to perceive. So much so that we're very straightjacketed. Once you get into meditation, all of those conditionings get bypassed and you start to perceive things in strange and different ways. That's why the world gets really weird at times. That's why you look at a carpet and the whole thing opens up and it's amazing what goes on in there. Sometimes people think they're going crazy, but you're not going crazy. The perception is getting its wings. You're seeing things in different ways. You're not being so straight-jacketed anymore in your perception. And this is actually what happens. And so it can be quite challenging to people, but it's really worthwhile challenging those fixed views we have about ourselves and life. Who we are, especially, is that fixed view is the worst one. Who you think you are. You think you're in control, but you're not in control. So, because of those fixed views, that's where we get into trouble. So when you let go of all views, put them aside for a while. Then you start to see things as they truly are. All insight, when I give a talk on insight later on, all insight should really not be what you expect to see. Otherwise it's not really insight anymore, it doesn't challenge you. All insight should be what you never expected to see. And that's a really great insight. Yeah.
Insight's kind of part of what I'm just giving.
More like visions, just ways of seeing. You say, my goodness, how could I not see this before? I've been really stupid. It's just like, you know, just paradigm shifts. Seeing things in a completely different way.
Is that a perception shift?
It also a perception shift as well. Perception, view, thought, all shift. So you don't think in terms of me and mine anymore. You don't think in terms of, you know, my body or my kids or my possessions. So the whole thing changes. Ajahn, the crucifixes have reminded me of a joke. Oh, great. A nice joke before we go to bed. I know this one. This is a good one. This is about the math, that's right. A young lad was having problems in the public school system. Misbehaving, swearing, teasing the girls, etc. So his parents moved him into a Catholic school. The nuns had been warned of his bad behaviour, so they were surprised that his behaviour was perfect. One day one of the nuns called him aside to say how well he was behaving. Never mind that, he said, pointing to the crucifix. I just want to know what he did to cheese you off so much. Now, the one I remember was the guy could never do his maths. And his maths was really terrible. And they tried sort of, you know, one school after another school, got him private tutors, and in the end they sent him to a Catholic school. And as soon as they sent him to a Catholic school, there he was doing his homework every night. His maths improved enormously. They said, why, how come it's so, you know, your maths is so much better, you're so much better at arithmetic? And is it because, you know, the nuns pay more attention to you? What's their special secret? He said, it's not the nuns, it's not no secret. As soon as I went into that school and I saw that kid nailed to the plus sign. That's what I remember. Not those jokes. Today I've hit a wall of depressed mood and sloth. I think this is a drawled handwriting as well. I don't want to get up or do anything. Stepped a bit but felt flat and down, unenthusiastic. Notice judgment of this tiredness. Hell. Okay, look, you're allowed to be slothful during this retreat. If you're really tired, get into it. It's very rare that people allow you to really get into slothfulness. See if you can sort of become an Olympic athlete in slothfulness. See how depressed you can become. Because a lot of times we get depressed about being depressed. We don't want to be slothful. I don't want to be depressed. And that's a problem, right? So, and if you are slothful and depressed, it's just the moods which go through the mind. It may be your body. Maybe the food you ate or something which happened today just makes you get slothful or depressed. It won't last. It can't last. It never does last. It'll either get better or it'll get worse. It won't last. It's always changing. That's one of the nice things about life. So even sloths move eventually. They sort of drag themselves out of their slothfulness. So if you don't want to get up and do anything, don't get up and do anything. Just enjoy being there. So again, it's not the slothfulness, not the depression, it's how you relate to that slothfulness and depression. So put the sloth, depression, whatever problem you have, put it out there. You're the one experiencing in here. What's going on between you in here and what you're experiencing? And that's where you actually make the difference. So if I see sloth and torpor out there and I'm in here, that's okay. It's not against the 8 precepts, not breaking the rules. I'm going to be at peace with my sloth and torpor. Sloth, torpor, restlessness, or no, laziness, the door of my heart's open to you in this retreat. So you can come in, I can be as slothful, as torpid as I possibly can. And after a while you just can't do it any longer, you get energy coming up. Because the sloth and torpor has come because either physically or because of just you've been trying too hard and it's getting tired now. So the way to actually overcome that is just rest, be at peace, accept it, make peace with it. If you make peace with those problems, energy comes up and the whole problem just disappears by itself. If you